And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, January 7th. Currently 26 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and Heber City reporting 32 degrees right now. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Wednesday, we're looking at partly to mostly cloudy skies. We'll start off with some sunshine. We'll see those clouds only increase through the afternoon hours. And by late this afternoon, we could see some scattered snow showers beginning to develop in the mountains and areas like Park City. Temperatures will climb into the upper 30s. Could see a couple of isolated rain or snow showers developing in the Heber Valley as temperatures will climb into the low to mid 40s. Now, as we go into tonight, a strong cold front moves through the area. That's going to drop those temperatures fast down into the low 20s by your Thursday morning. And that means the precipitation that will be ongoing with that front as it moves through will be in the form of snow. And we're talking about snow accumulations possible. About 3 to 6 inches expected overall on average for the Wasatch Back. Some of the higher mountaintops there in the Wasatch Back could pick up a little more like 4 to 8 inches. But you get the idea. A little decent covering of snow expected as we go throughout your Thursday. High temperatures will stay in the 20s in Park City for your Thursday, with highs in the mid-30s in the Heber Valley. Moving towards your Friday, get ready for the cold. The snow comes to an end, but we start to clear those skies out. Temperatures dip down into the low teens as we go into your Friday morning, with high temperatures only in the mid-20s for us in Park City on Friday. We'll see highs in the low 30s in the Heber Valley, just a chance of an isolated snow shower possible during the day. As we get into your weekend, the cold sticks around. Temperatures in the teens to single digits as we get towards your Saturday morning, with highs into the low 30s for us in Park City, highs in the mid-30s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Sunday, look for partly sunny skies. Temperatures starting off into the teens, with highs only around 40 degrees in the afternoon. Heading into next week, we're going to continue with high pressure ridging across the area. That's going to mean a lot of sunshine, but it's going to remain on the seasonably cool side, with morning low temperatures down into the teens to low 20s and highs around 40 degrees in Park City, with highs in the low to mid 40s in the Heber Valley. Watch out for a snowy Thursday morning commute. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes on an update with all of the development projects happening throughout the county. Later on, Acting Park City Manager Jody Emery, along with Deputy City Manager Heather Sneddon, previewing this week's City Council meeting, the first council meeting of the year, and organizer Brian Gardner, who has details on the ski touring event happening next week in Heber City. Later on, stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Dr. Josh Redd, who talks about how modern life fuels chronic inflammation, and his 30-day inflammatory reset, offering ways to get your energy, clarity, and vitality back. Then local entrepreneur and founder of Live Free, Dana Grinnell, talks about choosing healthy, non-toxic, thoughtfully packaged products for home and body, as well as an upcoming launch in a skincare line for young people. All of that, again, coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Still no phone in from Utah Avalanche Center, so looking at their report, the avalanche danger is considerable on upper elevation aspects facing west, north, and east. Human-triggered avalanches are likely, natural avalanches certainly possible, failing maybe 1 to 3 feet deep in that new or wind-drifted snow, but it can also step down to those weak layers that are buried up to 6 feet deep on those northerly slopes. Those would be huge, unsurvivable avalanches. The remaining upper elevation aspects and all mid-elevation aspects have a moderate danger, where human-triggered avalanches remain possible. Again, if you do trigger an avalanche near a ski area, please report it to Ski Patrol. Rescue personnel don't want to be subjected to dangerous conditions if the scene is clear. You can find out a lot more by going online to utahavalanchecenter.org. On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Thank you. You as well. Let's start with the fact, any interesting applications that have come through this past month?
I wouldn't say interesting from the perspective of the general public. Applications are obviously of significant interest to the applicant involved, but we're at that time of year. Most of the things we see are fairly minor, you know, small building addition here, a minor plat amendment there. At the planning commissions this next week, we actually have two public hearings at planning commissions, both planning commissions next week. And then minor plat amendments, one of them actually on the Snoutable Basin side is a plat amendment around Silver Creek to allow for the creation of a future roundabout at Silver Creek Drive. We're in essence as the county involved in that one. So that won't have significant implications for anybody. One that is not a public hearing at the Snoutable Basin Planning Commission next week, but has garnered significant interest in the past, the UOP, the Utah Olympic Park, will be back in front of the Planning Commission for a continued discussion and possible action. If you remember rightly, they were in front of the Planning Commission. It was the end of November, and they were looking to come back in December to answer some questions that the Planning Commission had. That process took a little bit longer, where we got our act together between ourselves as staff and the applicant, finalizing the details. So those answers will be brought to the Planning Commission next week. So those people who have been following along and want to stay interested, it is not a public hearing. The Planning Commission may take action at that time to forward it up to Council, where there will be future public hearings on the same item. So this is not the end of the process. This is partway through the process. But that one is probably of interest. Other items that people may see going on, not a planning item, but a construction item. We did receive the building permit a couple of days ago for phase two of the Canyons parking garage. So if anyone was following that rather rushed construction season to get that parking garage open for the ski season this year, they're coming back with a second building permit to continue. As soon as the ski season's over, then that's going to be back into a construction site and hopefully be completed during the next phase of construction. So that will be another exciting construction festival.
Okay, let's back up a little bit with regard to the UOP project. I had thought I was going to see maybe some changes to their applications, especially those lots that people were concerned about kind of at the top of the ridge there. So has anything changed from what was originally proposed?
The proposal that was on the table, there was, if you know, for those who were in attendance at the last meeting, there were statements made by the applicant about how they were going to reduce or restrict some of the earlier asks that they, you know, the claims that they were making, the requests that they had, and based on the public input, they were making changes. So those changes were being offered to the Planning Commission and were being stated by the applicant. But one of the reasons the Planning Commission, it was kind of split 50-50. Some of the members of the Planning Commission were saying, let's hold it back while we get confirmation of these details. And others were saying, well, let's not let the great be the enemy of the good and move to Council, because Council will more likely make some changes anyway. But those changes were offered at the meeting, and that's what caused the concern. We need to go away and make sure that all parties involved are clear about what is being asked, what is being offered, and what is being required. And that's really what this conversation is going to be about. There is an option for the Planning Commission, if the changes are substantive enough, to say, well, we really need to go back to the public, then they could actually take that option and say, we're not going to move it up. We want to go back and reopen the public hearing. From what I understood at the last commission meeting and from what's now been offered by the applicant, I don't see that happening, but it is an option.
Okay. And that's why there will be no public hearing, because it was closed earlier. Why was that done?
I think all the points had actually been made. Mm-hmm. I know there's, you know, there's a lot of strong opinions about what should and should not be done. Some of the answers were being given during the public hearing. And many members of the public were reassured. Others were still nervous. Well, how do we guarantee this? How do we make this happen? And that's probably the next stage of the process. But that was the second public hearing we'd had, and a lot of the comments we received were repeats of the first public hearing. So it's the same concern. The question is whether the answer being given and the reassurances being offered were adequate. And for some members of the Planning Commission, it was fine. For others, they were looking for more specificity. And that's what we've actually spent the last few weeks going backwards and forwards between the applicant and staff to make sure that we are all on the same page, understanding the same facts.
Okay. And then back to the phase two permit needed for the Canyons parking garage. Why is a second permit needed? I mean, wasn't this project approved?
It was approved at the planning level. This is actually just the building permit aspect of it. The project was approved in its entirety. It was approved by planning. So, you know, it's done from a planning perspective. But because of the break in the construction season, they couldn't run this they couldn't keep a construction site going and use the parking lot at the same time. So they issued a single building permit for the phase one to allow the construction of the garage. Then they have to shut it down as a construction site, move everybody off, make it safe, allow the parking garage to be used, and then reopen it again as a new construction site, phase two. So it's really more of the building permit aspect of it. You know, you'll see it might look a little untidy, especially as we don't have a lot of snow to cover up some of the aspects of it, but it's a safe and secure area as a parking garage, but it's not finished. So the next levels will be coming in as soon as ski season stops. Everybody leaves the site. The construction crews come back and we restart that. What looks like a chaotic, but is actually a very highly organized process.
Okay. So is the garage working? I haven't tried it. I mean, are we seeing big backups, you know, in the morning or cars trying to exit? I mean, we're talking about idling cars here.
I haven't heard anything. I've not seen it. I haven't had any reports of poor traffic. Some of that may, of course, be, are we running in a reduced traffic criteria right now because of, shall we say, the unfortunate lack of snow? But there was a traffic management plan involved. Obviously, when you're opening a garage that's partly constructed, it's not in its full operational capacity or its scenarios to how traffic is supposed to move. So my understanding is that part of the plan for operating during the ski season is to have a significant number of ski area canyon staff on site personally directing traffic. I have heard no report bad traffic. It doesn't mean they're not there, but I personally haven't heard any.
Okay. What's the latest with the Dakota Pacific Real Estate joint venture agreement?
That's actually with the staff, legal staff, management, and a couple of members of the council have been, you know, finalizing dotting I's and crossing T's. That's actually just the if people are fascinated by legal contracts being written as opposed to the agreements already been made, that's been a, you know, truly fascinating exercise, I say with pure sarcasm. Just going backwards and forwards, making sure we're all clear on terms. That agreement is essentially done and written. I think it's just awaiting signatures at this point. So I don't think there's any differences of opinion or how we should proceed. So that's just in the editing stage of a legal document. Similarly with Klein Dolly, if you remember rightly, we've been talking with the RFP winner on that project for a while now. We're still discussing the arrangement as to how the process will take place, not the design of the project. Hopefully that process is now wrapping up and we can get on with the design and hopefully construction of a project in that location.
We've
been in this slow paperwork production side, not the fun aspects of design.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that, but back to the Dakota Pacific. Given that this joint venture agreement is you know, basically done, does that mean we will see construction starting this spring?
You might see some minor enabling works. I believe in seriousness. The first thing that really is going to happen that people will begin to set up and take sudden notice of is when for example, the Richens building goes away, the existing transit center goes away, and excavation starts on that parking garage at Thousand Space, semi-subterranean parking garage. I don't imagine that happening until the end of this year, possibly early next. Then there may be some enabling work, some small projects where infrastructure might take place, small, you know, road arrangements. You know, there might be, it's more likely we'll be looking at applications for projects, you know, so the building aspect, the subdivision aspect, the design of buildings, rather than full-blown construction. We, the county, obviously, if people are aware that the county bought the old Skullcandy building, we as the county are actually in the lower levels of the Skullcandy right now, remodeling that so we can move the library and other offices out of the Richens building into the lower level of the Skullcandy building. So that interior, people won't see anything until much later on in the year when suddenly it'll become an interesting exercise to watch.
What was your choice for the new name, for the new name of the Skullcandy building?
I deliberately stayed away from it, but Bailey Smith, one of the staff in the planning offices, actually she was one of those shortlisted candidates who chose one of those names. I don't know which one, and I wouldn't want to influence the vote. It's treat it like an election. This is going to go out to a public survey, I believe, and a vote for the most popular name.
Okay, and then back to the Klein Dolly parcel. I believe there's a new zone that's being considered for this parcel. I mean, and I'm going to ask, is that good planning, spot zoning?
Is spot zoning good planning? There's a wealth of interesting subjects. I would say no. I would rather we plan in advance. One of the issues we've had with all our mixed use zones right now, we have a commercial zone, a service commercial zone, and we created the neighborhood mixed use zone. There are minor flaws and hiccups in it that don't allow this project to take place in the format as presented. So at the very least, we tweak what we call an MU1 zone to allow, you know, a slight variation of uses and slight differences of technical standards. Or there is the alternative method where we create a wholly new zone that describes projects of this type. My dream and want is that as a design exercise, we can design a project that we know works, create a zone that allows it, and then use that as a model zone to apply to other properties around the basin. It shouldn't be a zone, should not be written and cannot be written for the benefit of one developer, and that includes ourselves. So a zone that we create that people will be required to apply for, including this project, will create the zone. Then we apply for the zone and we go through the public hearing process. Hopefully it describes a project we want and is not something that is just done by a negotiated agreement. It's actually a public process for a zone that describes the land and vision of the type of community we're after.
Okay. My understanding is that applications for the Summit County Planning Lab are open.
We're very excited about that. If people want to go to the planning department website, or, you know, go to the Summit County, you know, navigate your way through websites, like as all children are expert at doing and all people my age and really bad at doing, you'll find the planning and zoning pages, the Community Planning Lab, Spring 2026. Where we have two excited, fairly recent employees of the planning department, Mustafa Osman and Elizabeth Williams. Mustafa is a recent graduate of the U master's program, and Liz has actually been in the field in peripheral planning jobs for a long time, made a career out of it, has actually been working as a planner in Wyoming until she joined us. Those two excited, you know, younger members of staff volunteered to pick up the reins that were left behind when, obviously, Madeline McDonough went to join the housing department, and Jennifer Leslie, actually, she left to go, you know, go find another career in life elsewhere. But the lab had got off to a fabulous start based on the work that Maddie and Janet Janelle had created, and we were just hoping someone would be interesting to pick it up and run with it, because it is an exercise. It's a lot of hard work, but you yourself, Leslie, went through the process. I hope you have good things to say about it. I would recommend it to anybody who wants to make a positive contribution to the planning world and improve our community. Please look at the webpage, look at the syllabus, decide if you're interested. Contact Mustafa or Liz, and hopefully we'll sign up and get a whole host of applications.
Well, your segment on the history of planning from caveman times is fascinating. So, yeah, people wouldn't want to miss that. I don't know. Where do you start? Yeah, I mean, you go way, way, way back to, like, the Roman Empire.
Before that, I think we start with the basis of human settlement. I do find it amusing that I do, you know, the history of the world in 20 minutes, and then, you know, wrap up the modern world. And the reason for doing that, you study history, not because an Italian philosopher said this, you don't do this because it teaches you how to walk, but it teaches you the nature of the ground upon which you walk. So why does worker housing in 1950s UK look just like worker housing in ancient Egypt? There are reasons for this. We can follow them through. Why does human settlement patterns follow similar means and methods throughout the whole of human history? If we know why, what's the good and the bad, then we can project that forward and we can modify it in our own means. So it's a class that I indulge myself in. It's the most enjoyable time of year for me. So I hope other people get some benefit from it too.
Okay, Peter, I'm going to leave it there. But anything we should be watching out for in the planning world in the upcoming legislative session?
All those people who are fascinated by sausage being made, please pay attention to legislative session. If you see anything that raises a red flag with you, call me, because it's bound to raise a red flag with me. We have teams of people following it on a regular basis, but it's all a mystery until the bill is revealed, and then we're all dealing with the aftermath. And, you know, we would really like to get ahead of stuff. So if people are following and fascinated, please stay in touch. Let me know, and I'll let the public know as soon as I can.
Okay. Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Bye now.
Well, the newly seated Park City Council and Mayor will open the first meeting of the year on Thursday, starting at 3:30 in the Park City Council chambers. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have Acting City Manager Jody Emery, along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Heather?
Good morning.
There you are. Okay, let's see. Jody, a short closed session will be held just before the work session, and I know we can't discuss items, but is this just an opportunity for council members and the new mayor to hear from the legal staff about things that can and cannot be discussed in closed session, or
yes.
Just an update? I mean, really, it's an overview?
Just there's a couple updates that they have to give the new council.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The meeting does open with the Park City Water Service District meeting. And again, I didn't know we had this Water Service District. So the board is basically comprised of the council, similar to what we have, like the RDA or Housing Authority?
Correct. That's how it works.
Okay. The council is set. The board is set to act on a memorandum of agreement to continue leasing surplus water to Weber Basin. Explain why Park City needs to lease back water that Summit County taxpayers are already paying to lease water from Weber Basin in the first place.
So Park City is a party to the Western Summit County project that was developed and executed in 2013. That was in part to ensure a reliable and redundant water supply to the Snyderville Basin and Park City, and it regionalizes our water supply and infrastructure between parties and engages Weber Basin to provide wholesale water. Council's going to consider authorizing the mayor to execute this agreement that will continue leasing surplus water to Weber Basin. We've been leasing water in this capacity for the past 5 years. It's worth about $30 million over the five-year term of the lease. And so that's a significant portion of revenue. It generates revenue for Park City to help offset the costs of delivering the water service.
Okay. When you say makes money, I mean, are we making money here? I mean, or does it have to be leased back to what we pay for it?
Does it have to be leaseback for what we pay for? We have surplus water capacity in Park City because of years of conservation and long-term planning. And if we didn't lease the water, we wouldn't get any value of it. So it allows us to use excess water, excess capacity that we have to make some revenue to offset some of the costs. And Park City water is expensive water.
Yeah. I guess, is the city paying, though, to treat the water? But again, because we've got water coming from Rockport over Promontory.
Correct.
Into Quinns Junction treatment plant there. Is this water getting treated, or is this still the raw water that's just being left now in Rockport?
My understanding is it's water that's being treated, and it's actually primarily out of Spiro. I don't want to misspeak. I don't know the details of where that water is coming from, but that's my understanding. And it's a temporary lease, so we aren't committed to it necessarily beyond the lease terms.
I guess, did Weber Basin overextend itself? I mean, why does it need the water?
The majority of the water is actually going to Summit Water. So Weber Basin is then subleasing the water to Summit Water. And it's the redundancy in the system is so that we all have water when we need it. So there may be a time when we don't have any surplus and we can pull surplus from elsewhere. But the other thing this lease is doing is actually delaying a costly infrastructure project. A new water importation project would be much more expensive for the Weber Basin and Summit Water than leasing this water.
All right, because those are water rights that Summit Water Company owns in the East Canyon Reservoir, which
Correct.
Would have to be pumped back uphill
Right.
in order for them to use.
And any water project like that would be much more expensive than
Okay.
this lease.
All right. Let's see. Looking at that dry year water report in the staff report, I noticed that Theriot Spring no longer producing water. So what happened there?
Leslie, I don't know. I apologize. I'm not familiar
McAfee
with that.
It's a question?
Yep. We'll bring Clinton.
Okay. And now the big construction project that we saw along State Route 224 this summer and fall,
mm-hmm.
again, was part of this water redundancy
yes.
project.
Yep.
So is that finished or is there more to do?
I believe the majority of it is finished, and at least it is along 224. Our portion of that project is done. And yes, those pipes were put in to help get that water out to Summit Water.
Okay, and all parties participated in the cost of that redundancy work?
Great question.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
All right. Heather, I think you're the one up for the Recreate 248. There's a work session on this. What's the latest?
You know, the latest is we're bringing back the Recreate 248 transit study. This is the level 2 screening results that we'll be providing to the council, and this meeting is really designed as a discussion of those results. We designed the study to go through a federally compliant process, so we preserve the potential availability of some federal funding for the project. And these level 2 screening results will provide more of the technical analysis and the public input that the council has requested to help them identify a locally preferred alternative for the SR 248 corridor.
So we have not identified a locally preferred alternative, an LPA, at this point?
Not yet. The council will be discussing that at this coming meeting, and then potentially we have a placeholder at the January 20th meeting to continue that discussion. But the alternatives that have been analyzed at this point and that are being presented with kind of the performance metrics are bus side running, bus center running, and light rail. And based upon the findings from our screening results, the bus-based alternatives really perform the best overall when you're balancing cost, feasibility, ridership, mobility benefits, delivery timeline, those kinds of things, and particularly the bus side running. The light rail showed higher ridership potential, but it really comes with significantly higher costs and implementation challenges. So those are the results that we'll be sharing with council on Thursday.
Okay, and I guess I never was really clear about where a light rail would start and finish. Was that identified?
You know, those things are still kind of up for discussion. You know, what's really been a significant piece of, well, will become a significant piece of this discussion is park and rides. That will be kind of a combined discussion, particularly at the January 20th meeting, because we really need to identify for these locally preferred alternatives what are the termini, and particularly on the east side, as we talked about, you know, potentially Gordo as a park and ride location, Richardson Flat as a park and ride location. Those items will be discussed on the 20th, because when we identify this locally preferred alternative, we really want to know where it's going to start and end, because that's going to allow us to push into the next phase of our analysis, which is really the environmental review, design, and funding applications.
All right. I guess what is it that we're trying to do besides, I mean, what it sounds like is that we don't want to make a four-lane road from U.S. 40 to Park Avenue, State Route 224. I mean, it sounds like we want to maintain this hourglass road style.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we're really trying to achieve here is to reduce number of trips. And if we can't implement, you know, this Recreate 248 corridor with bus rapid transit or light rail, depending on what the council decides, we're hoping that we'll be able to park cars outside of the city and bring people in through bus rapid transit, making it all the way into ultimately Old Town, and having an opportunity for fewer cars on the road.
Mm-hmm. Do buses then run into the same problem that all of the vehicles do? That is, that they get merged into the single lane?
You know, I don't know the details of that, Leslie, but I do know what we're hoping for is some dedicated, you know, lanes for buses. And ultimately, we'll have to, you know, determine how best those transition into, you know, lanes where the terminus of the bus rapid transit is.
All right. Looking quickly at the timeline, it looks like it could be another 2 years of design and environmental study after we have an LPA, and then another 2 years to build. This puts us close to like 2030. Is that what you understand?
That is correct. The project delivery timeline on projects of this size and scope is just significant. And that's even with, you know, really moving forward aggressively as much as we can, because we have to go through that environmental review. And that is also part of this federally compliant process to ensure that we have federal funds available to us. We then go through detailed design. We have to get some right-of-way acquisition, permitting. We go through utility coordination. We have to procure the right vehicles. There's a lot of multi-agency funding approvals that we have to go through. So it is a pretty long process, and that's why we're kind of chomping at the bit here to identify that locally preferred alternative so we can push forward and hopefully deliver something ahead of the 2034 Winter Olympics.
All right. So is this on UDOT's STIP list? I mean, that's the list that's has funding for the next 10 years?
You know, that's a good question. I would assume the answer is yes. I know that we have some funding dedicated to this project already. We're going to pursue, you know, other funding options as well.
Okay. Bonanza Flat. Jody, the plan is back before the city council. I guess why? What's it, just an update, or are we talking about perhaps modifications to the management plan?
There is a timeline in place. We have a 5-year review timeline, so this is the first of those, you know, regular 5-year reviews. It's just an update on the 2025 season, as well as Utah Open Lands will be coming in to talk about the adaptive management and stewardship plan.
Okay, and as we know, we've got kind of the purple bus making its way up to the montage area where people will then have to hike to get, I guess they can pick up another shuttle on weekends only there.
Correct.
At the montage. Is that how that works?
That is how that works.
Yeah, so it looks like people are using the transit, which is a great thing, but, you know, I've heard from people living like in Upper Park Meadows or, you know, even in, you know, Jeremy Ranch, about how do they access it? I mean, there's no bus that comes by them. I mean, this would be an all-day adventure, right? And that's kind of like, why can't we keep the parking lot there where Anaya's was off of Bonanza until something gets built there? Just so it makes it an easy shuttle. So it's you know, you park there and you drive up to the top of Guardsmen one shot. Otherwise, you're asking people to get on a bus to get to the Old Town Transit Center or to pay for parking?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the idea, is we're trying to reduce trips and we're trying to reduce cars in, you know, in the congested area of Park City. So the idea is to get the purple bus from the Old Town Transit Center So if you are coming from Park Meadows or another neighborhood, I suppose you could park closer if parking's available in town, and then hop on that purple bus up to catch the shuttle. It has been really popular. Transit ridership has increased, and we're seeing a 90% approval rating for riders. And we're averaging hundreds of riders per day on the weekends. It's just been a tremendous success from our perspective. And we're also seeing a lot of repeat ridership. One thing I will say, you mentioned the locals. We did issue 1,200 free local parking permits last year, which is amazing. But our residents are actually only accounting for about 5 to 7% of the users in the area. That's during this summer. But what this has done is it's allowed us to fund this increased shuttle service, which has been very successful.
Yeah. And as you know, I work on Sundays. And so what I see happening is that, you know, people show up to the City Hall parking lot. They plug in their electric vehicle. They put on their ski gear. They walk down to the transit center. They get a free ride to. So they're getting a free car charge. They're getting a free ride up to Bonanza. And yet they're not paying any city taxes. I mean, is there some way to ensure that anybody doing that is actually helping to support it?
Well, I think what you're seeing is in the summer usage
is
really what's paying for the winter usage. And that's where we made the revenue that we're able to then put back into these amazing, it's better for all of us to reduce the parking congestion up there in that area. I don't know if you've ever tried to park up there, but it's a crapshoot if you're going to find a spot. We do have cameras, so you can look ahead of time. But it just allows you to go up there without even worrying about it.
Okay, let's get a quick update on the sales taxes. I think this is just for October.
This is just for October. Mm-hmm. Yep. So citywide sales tax, excluding the TRT, was down a bit. But what we're seeing is October's 11% decrease is actually, we're calling it noise and normalization. It's not a trend break. We had an unusually high October. Taxes are complicated because it's when is it collected and then when is it distributed? And sometimes what we see the changes has to do with when it's being distributed rather than what's been collected. But what we're seeing is it's stable to modestly positive versus the plan.
Okay, and we've got some Sundance approvals after this, pretty much done with all of that, ready to go?
Yes, so this was the deadline for regular single events, late single events. Liquor was January 2nd, and we only accept 12 late single event liquor licenses, so this is the last opportunity for those to go through, and then we also have the convention sales licenses.
Okay, the city council has to approve the single event liquor licenses, mm-hmm. in addition to the state, huh?
Absolutely, yep, okay. And it's all part of the state's deadlines. That's why we're on this timeline.
All right. Also, an update on the Public Arts Advisory Board strategic plan. Anything we need to know about this? Because later on, the council will be adopting the Arts and Council master plan. Is that Heather?
Yes. Yeah. We are just presenting the 2026 strategic plan from the Public Art Advisory Board. This is really just identifying, priorities for 2026, and that includes the Artful Bike Rack program, some additional transit shelter artwork, hopefully some trail art, and those prioritizations, and hoping the council will support us in those prioritizations. And then, yes, later in the meeting, we will also be discussing the Arts and Culture Master Plan, which we've already received a presentation on from Park City, Summit County Arts and Culture, or the Arts Council, and they will be presenting that for a resolution for the council to support it going forward. And that's for, kind of broader-based, future-looking recommendations on how to incorporate arts and culture into our city.
Okay. The council vacancy application period ended Monday. We ended up with 10 applicants. So what happens now?
So we have interviews scheduled for Tuesday. They will be doing those in a public way, so you can tune in or show up. And then council will possibly make an appointment next week at its January 15th meeting.
Okay, so they plan to interview all 10 in one day?
They will be interviewing all 10 in one day.
Okay, any idea what the council, mayor, are looking for?
No, I mean, I don't, actually. I can't read their minds, but I know that if you were at the swearing-in the other day, everybody's really looking forward to getting some stuff done. And so I would assume that they'll be looking for that.
Interviews have to be done in closed session. What about deliberations? Does that also have to be done?
No, I'm sorry. Interviews are done in public.
Yes, interviews are done in public. Mm-hmm. Council deliberations about that.
No. That will be done on the January 15th meeting.
In open meeting?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, no deliberation may be done in closed.
Okay. All right, ladies, anything else?
No, I don't have anything. Heather, do you have anything?
I don't think so.
Okay. Heather Snyder.
I don't.
Jody Emery, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the action-packed competition of ski touring, where a horse and a rider and a skier are all involved, returns to the Heber Valley for 2 days later this month. On the phone with details, I have Brian Gardner. He's one of the organizers of the event. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so Brian, we were talking about this in a news meeting. How do you say it? Is it ski join, the emphasis on ski, or is it skijoring?
You know what? People say it both ways, and I don't know that there's a wrong way to say it, so either way works.
Okay. Well, I've always called it skijoring, so that's what I'll call it. But for people who may be new to this event, can you briefly explain what the sport is and how it works?
Sure. Skijoring is just an action-packed race. It's very, very unique. People just are drawn to it naturally. There's not really a demographic of people that enjoy it because it's just fascinating to anyone. It's a horse and a rider that pull a skier. The skier is holding onto a rope being pulled behind the horse at generally a fast rate of speed through a race course. And the race course is similar to a slalom course. It has gates that the skier has to make turns around those gates. And those gates will incorporate big jumps, grabbing rings, and navigating your way through this course as quickly as you can. And competitors race for time. So it's going down the course as quickly as possible, but also skiing cleanly and trying not to miss any gates or miss any of the rings or obstacles, as there are time deductions as you do so. So it's just a fast-paced, super unique, super fun sport. And the event itself has just become very festival-like, and the vibe is just a lot of fun, and people love to come out and see it.
Okay, well, give us the details, when, where, and how much.
Sure. So this kind of a special year for us. This is our 10th year anniversary. We're in Heber, Utah, at the Wasatch County Event Center. And the event is coming up next weekend, January 16th and 17th. And the race happens both days, both Friday and Saturday. Folks are welcome to come out either day. Obviously, Saturday is generally the busiest day of the two. And tickets start around $20. It just depends. There's VIP sections. There's different seating options. Ticket prices vary a little bit from Friday to Saturday. One of the values of the Saturday ticket is when you buy a Saturday ticket, you can attend Friday for free. So there is kind of a bonus value there.
So weather, of course, has been the topic du jour. How are the weather conditions affecting what you're going to do? I mean, you got to have snow to ski on.
Yes. Very, very, very fair question. So we have, and it's also a neat history here in Utah. So Ski Touring Utah is the founding event, and that is what we are celebrating, the 10th year anniversary. But we have grown and expanded into a pro tour that has multiple stops across Utah, Idaho, and Montana, and with the championship finals coming back to Utah at the end of February. And because of that, we've made a substantial investment in snowmaking equipment because weather, as we know here, can vary year to year. And so we have snowmaking equipment, and similar to the ski resorts, we need to have cold overnight temperatures, and we have had some. And so we have been blowing snow over at the event complex in Heber. And the good news is, so we have some pile stockpiled there now. And the good news is the next few nights ahead of us, the temps are looking great for snowmaking. So we will be making snow probably the next four or five nights in a row straight. And then we will build the course next week starting Monday. And we will be ready for the event the following weekend.
Awesome. Okay. So good luck with that. Now, is this like a rodeo where you've got like contestants who like go from place to place, or is this just like a yeehaw kind of event where anybody who wants to sign up can sign up to participate?
You know, great question. And I think what's really neat, and Utah is just has been so amazing, so supportive of this. And in a way, we really believe it's Utah's sport. I mean, Utah has such a, obviously such a strong ski heritage and a ski culture, but mixed with just an amazing tradition of ranching and agriculture. And it really brings those two worlds together. So when we started the event in 2017, it really was more about just getting together and doing something fun. And we've been able to develop that more into a pro sport. So both things still hold true today. If you're new to the sport and you've never tried it and would like to try it, we have all sorts of divisions, from novice division. We have some fun divisions, the century division, where the age of the rider and the skier need to equal 100 years. We have a teen division. So we have those entry-level divisions where anyone can come and learn and become part of the sport and develop. And then that graduates up into the sport and pro and women's, which are now competitive divisions, which you do have teams who do travel from similar to rodeo, as you mentioned, from event to event to event. And with our new tour, which is called the Pro Ski Jor Tour, which is actually the first organized pro ski joring tour in North America, you can compete at numerous events, earn points along the way, earn money along the way, and qualify for what is the world championships. Again, similar to rodeo. So there really is both sides to it. It's very, you can be very entry level beginner, and you can participate all the way up to pro level.
So can the same be said for the horses that are used? I mean, are there horses, slower horses that would be used for the novices, and, you know, real competitive horses for the competitors?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, that is something that's really fun to watch, is that the horses really enjoy this. You know, you see them come up to the start line and just they know it, they feel it, they feel the energy of the crowd, and they start to get excited, and they're just ready to go. So in your pro divisions, yes, 100%. There are horses that do this regularly and are not only fast and athletic, but are quite skilled at it and really have learned a course and how best to manage and navigate the course with their rider. So on that pro level, you have that. On that novice level, listen, the horse is just there to go the speed that the skier needs to go, even if that's a trot, as they are just learning the sport. So yes, very great question. The horses as well compete at all levels.
Yeah. And is there any opportunity to practice before the event?
On a normal year, yes. On a normal year, we generally build a practice course and give the opportunity for folks to come out and practice and give it a try. On a year like this, where snow has been limited, you know, our advice to those with horses is just to spend the time with their horse in the arena, in their pasture, getting them used to, you know, towing something, have a rope attached to the saddle, pulling a sled or a tire behind them in the arena or their pasture, you know, obviously getting their horse in shape. So all of those things can be done without having snow. And as far as the skier goes, you know, practicing on the ski hill, I mean, it really is very similar to slalom skiing. So quick turns, edge to edge. Anybody with a ski racing background excels in this sport. So just being in great physical condition and having strong fundamental skiing skills can really contribute. For the skier, rope management, as we call it, is something that takes a little bit of practice. But that's also something that if they can't get behind a horse, but they can get behind a snowmobile somewhere or an ATV somewhere in a field or go up to a higher elevation and just practice in that rope and pulling that rope and working on that tension, they can do so. So there are ways to practice even when there isn't a lot of snow, both for the horse and rider and for the skier.
Okay. So what kind of turnout are you kind of expecting, both in terms of the competitors and spectators?
Yeah, you know, again, we just feel so lucky. The community that's established itself here around ski joring over the last 10 years is just such a great group of people. So it's grown. The sport has grown exponentially. Last year at our event, we ran 375 competing teams. So that's just amazing. That's a lot of people that are coming out to participate and be involved in the sport. And from a spectator standpoint, the last few years, we've consistently had right around 10,000 attendees. So it's a lot of people show up to watch it. And as I mentioned before, there's not really a demographic. You don't necessarily have to be into skiing or snowboarding, and you don't necessarily have to be into horses or rodeo to enjoy this sport. I think it just captures the imagination, and people love to come out and enjoy it. And in addition, you know, the festival vibe is kind of growing around it. There's food vendors and specialty product vendors and leather vendors and it's just a music. This year we're having a live band play on the track immediately after the races on Saturday and inviting the crowd to come down and dance to the live band. Friday night, we're having a kickoff party that's sponsored by Lobos Tequila, and that's at the Black Mountain Resort. And so people come out for the kickoff party and are able to interact with the athletes and enjoy them. So just a whole vibe that everybody really seems to enjoy.
Okay. People can get more information again. What's that website?
Pro skijor, skijor.com.
Okay. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you so much.